when I was in the House when you were finance minister. And the one I really remember is where you brought a tree for all of us. And you said it's, I think it was the delivery of the first surplus. Mm. And you said that it's really important. Surpluses are important, not in and of themselves, but because they mean that you are planting today for tomorrow. Could you take us back to that moment and say, do you still believe that?
I think the point about public finance is that it's all interconnected in time as well. The minute you think that you can take a decision that's transactional, you've lost it. Part of what we're talking about in the US is too many transactional decisions.
Lovely to be here with you on the Power Chat once again, this time with the former finance minister and the chairperson of an important report on growth, debt and development opportunities for a new African partnership, Trevor Manuel. Very welcome.
Thank you very much, Friedel. Can I, for one time, not be a former something and just be me?
Absolutely. Trevor, lovely to chat to you. So I thought I might start, if you don't mind, because I feel like our G20 is being defined by the absence of the USA. But in fact, if you look at who is coming, it really is going to shape into quite an interesting gathering. How should we understand the decision of US President Donald Trump? And how should we see this meeting on our continent for the first time and in Johannesburg?
The interesting challenge about Donald Trump is that at times you think it's G1 plus the rest of the world. But in this case, it's P1, the person one, Donald J. Trump and the rest of the world, because until recently there was a fair amount of participation. He'd indicated that the Vice President, J.D. Vance, would attend. And some of the other participants, including the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, had participated in meetings, and suddenly pulls the rug. Now, it's very difficult in times like this when the emphasis of the G20 is largely on collaboration, on working together to find solutions to difficult problems, to have an individual be able to decide what happens. And if you allow the world to be held in check by a single individual, I think we sell our children short.
Do you see shifts in the world that's getting tired of this kind of histrionics of the one, and that you see, in fact, a showing of people coming? So many European heads of state are coming. By last count, 16 country heads of state of the G20 are going to be it, maybe one less today. Do you think that people are tiring of this kind of unilateralism, or is it the way of the world we live in today?
Look, I think there is a seminal moment. There is a kind of sense of rupture in the world at the moment. The world that we've known, that all of us have grown up in, the world that in many respects was shaped by the horrors of World War I and World War II, which then created a sense of collaboration. And in that collaboration, a number of institutions. If you look at the horrors of World War I, and before World War II actually ended, an agreement to establish the United Nations. Within that, things like the Geneva Convention and how to treat prisoners of war, a kind of emphasis on respect. And all of that is being taken apart. I mean, there isn't a person in the world anywhere, regardless of where you stand in the world, that can turn on television and see the horrors in Palestine and not ask what happened to the kind of civilization that came after the end of World War II. All of that is broken now. And part of that whole agreement was that countries must find a way of getting on. Now, of course, there were always negotiations because things weren't quite according to the textbook. Mm-hmm. And it proceeded at one level. And after the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, there was a new order, new agreements, new countries created with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. You know, things were getting on, and now there's a lot of difference. It's very interesting because from if you look at the period through the 1980s, there was a lot of stuff that was done by Reagan and Thatcher, and it all was covered by the notion of neoliberalism.
Right.
The truth of the matter is, of course, that as that notion took root, the biggest beneficiaries were actually Asian countries. And in the last 25 years, from the time that China joined the World Trade Organization in Doha in 2001, the world changed again and very rapidly. The U.S. thought that they would free up themselves and change banking laws. And no sooner that happened than you had the Great Recession, the exuberance, irrational exuberance is what Greenspan called it, of markets taking control of things, and then the collapse of Lehman Brothers and effectively the shutdown of the United States. And since then, you've had all manner of things. Amongst the things that you've seen happen is the rise of billionaires. And so many people in the U.S. and elsewhere just falling through the cracks. You've seen far more drug abuse, far more poverty, far more homelessness and unemployment in the U.S. and elsewhere.
It's amazing
so the world
to see
now
those.
Is a very, very different place. You know?
Very different. For me, it's rather shocking to watch the shutdown in America and to see people who you would used to get food stamps now standing in food queues again. It's shifting quite quickly. And I'm wondering how your clarion calls for shared responsibility and mutuality in this report, which is a very pithy report. How do you think it will land in the world? Are the ears listening to this, or is it dog eat dog again?
I think that many people in the developing world will sit up and take notice and kind of feel a sense of reassurance. Other people are making the calls that they'd like to have made themselves, and that's always positive. The situation in the U.S. is, I don't understand it. I don't understand the fact that you have levels of poverty that we see, yet the belief that this is the redeemer of the U.S. and the world is a very strong belief. I mean, more than half of Americans voted for him, and so that's the moment we're in. Perhaps in the next year or so, things will come to the fore, and because it depends on what you measure. If you want to measure the performance of the stock exchange, almost everywhere, the stock exchange share prices are rising, and you can say, "Oh, the economy must be really outperforming itself." The truth of the matter is, while share prices are rising, food prices are also rising. So poor people can't afford to live. You see this, and it was evidenced also in the mayoral elections in New York. Transport costs, rental costs, food costs. The issues that really matter in the lives of people are unaffordable, and I think that becomes a universal issue. How do we deal with that going forward?
Well, New York has chosen a young Zoran Mamdani, which, as somebody who lives in Joburg and is looking forward to the elections next year, I wish we had such a person. So South Africa at the weekend got S&P upgraded to double B, I think, of its long-term sovereign credit rating. What did you think when you read that?
I was very excited. I feel excited about what seemed like a difficult situation a few months ago, where it appeared that there was a marginal disagreement between the central bank governor and the minister of finance on how to call the inflation target going forward. And when the MTBPS landed, and the minister came out supporting a lower target, I think the signals were positive, and that converted very quickly into a reward. That statement is a fundamental reward. That reward comes through in the form of greater certainty of investors, because the numbers are more trustworthy. You will see capital inflows. You will see greater commitment to investments going forward. And that is exceedingly good for the country.
And do the other agencies tend to follow, or is it not a normal thing?
They tend to follow. I don't see that S&P's would be an outlier. I mean, going back to the early period when we first got credit ratings, S&P was always the outlier on the downside.
Interesting.
We could persuade Moody's, and S&P would be hard nuts to crack. And so it's very encouraging that they're the first movers on an upgrade now.
Well, I'm coming to what the report says about the credit ratings agencies in a while. So I do want to go back to a couple of seminal budgets when I was in the House when you were finance minister. And the one I really remember is where you brought a tree for all of us. And you said it's important. I think it was the delivery of the first surplus. Mm. And you said that it's really important. Surpluses are important, not in and of themselves, but because they mean that you are planting today for tomorrow. Could you take us back to that moment and say, do you still believe that?
I think the point about public finance is that it's all interconnected in time as well. The minute you think that you can take a decision that's transactional, you've lost it. Part of what we're talking about in the US is too many transactional decisions. Part of what we need to see more of in this country is decisions that are interconnected. And they're hard decisions. They're hard because the decisions impact on the lives of people. And so we needed to tighten. I mean, and go back all the way to 1996, when we needed to tighten up on the size of the deficit. We needed to tighten up on the size of the deficit so that we could free up resources. Because when you have deficits, then you're spending on debt service, not on public services. And part of what is reflected in the report that we'll come to in a moment is when countries borrow, they are always true to the bankers. Countries tend to service their debts with the banks, but in servicing their debts, they don't service their responsibilities to the people. So we see on the African continent, for instance, that the number of countries that spend more on debt service than they do on health, the provision of health, or they spend more on debt service than they do on the provision of education. It's a deep tragedy. So you have a developmental crisis because countries meet their debt obligations without actually meeting their development obligations. Getting the balance right is always important. So I'm saying, going back to 96, that became an important point for us. So we decided to tighten in the deficit, and we were very unpopular for that. But within 2 years, we were able to introduce, for instance, a child support grant, which was an exceedingly positive move, reaching out to the children of the poor and being able to improve on the quality of life where it mattered most. And that was the beginning of big things in government, because we could then demonstrate that we could deal with these issues, because what you need is a very clear frame of reference for public finance, but you also must have strong treasury control. And treasury control, I'm hoping, will follow what we saw in the medium-term budget policy statement. And what I'd like to see in treasury control, for me, I'm just an old pensioner now, what I'd like to see in treasury control is more oversight over what happens with supply chain managers, management. We spend too much on goods and services. There's poor negotiation. We overpay for things as a people, and we get poor quality of what we've paid for. That's one aspect. And the other is human resource development in the public sector. It's unbalanced, and we spend too much on wage costs in the public service. If we can restore that, then I think we will build the room that allow us to introduce new policies that have a longer impact.
That's what I remember of the time. It was building the space to do things and
it's
not being in hock to the bankers.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to be on our continent right now, because when you travel in Dakar, you go to Nairobi, when you go to many, many capitals, you just get the sense of a place that's about to grow, because it has so many young people. But if you read the ADB forecast, similarly, on the other hand, debt is such a chokehold, as the report has found. Can you shape some of how big that choke is, how big the debt constraints are to our continent and the broader developing world? I know it's a big question.
It's a big question, but the problem with debt is that you don't have uniform debt across the continent. The one issue is that it depends on who the money is owed to. Now, there's been a very interesting history, and again, you can look at this over the past 30 or so years. There was a jubilee led by the Vatican a few years ago that resulted in an initiative called HIPC, the Highly Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, that saw debt relief for the poorest countries that had the highest debt levels. And it was a major, major victory. It took a lot of pulling and shoving and arguing for. And that was in about 1997 that jubilee found resonance. The tragedy was that the structures of those economies weren't changed. And so in about 7 or 8 years, many of those countries fell back into debt. One of the lessons from that is that we have to focus on restructure. One of the big shifts that has happened is at the time of the last jubilee, that HIPC jubilee, the IMF and the World Bank had structural adjustment programs. Every African country hated ESAPs, and we worked hard, and there was a commission led by the former Ghanaian finance minister Kwesi Botchwe that demonstrated empirically why the structural adjustment programs needed to be abandoned, and the Bank and Fund listened, and so they moved away from that. So this left us with an opportunity to reshape what we were doing as African leaders together. One of the issues that had actually happened is countries felt positive when they were able to, and they used the term graduate from the dependence on borrowing from the IMF and the World Bank. Many countries then went to the Eurobond market and borrowed there. And increasingly we've seen in the last while China becoming a bigger and bigger creditor to Africa. So those are big changes. The challenge that now confronts us is that in some parts of the world, we can still try and persuade creditors to take a bit of a haircut, to restructure debts. China have a view that they have legislation that prohibits taking haircuts. So if you haven't negotiated better rates at the point at which you borrow, you're stuck with that.
Mm.
So it's a difficulty because there's going to be no jubilee from China. There's no engagement as you can do with the World Bank, the IMF, and that is one of the issues of the present. And we've seen the implications of Eurobond lending as well, because the conditions have been pretty severe. And if you look at countries that have defaulted, like Ghana, more recently, and Zambia, they don't have a diversity of creditors. It's the Eurobond market and People's Republic of China. So it's very, very difficult. And these are the issues we have to work through. And that is why building a cohesive African voice becomes so important.
And what a cohesive voice you've built. So the 25 people you brought together, it's a very, it's such a diverse grouping of people. How did you, is this just your personal contact book that you use from years of being an African finance minister? And it also crosses quite a big ideological sweep. You've got Hannah Ryder on here, Fiona Trigena. I can go through it, but you tell me how you put it together.
Look, there were a number of people who were must-haves for us. Including those must-haves are people who, the first and obvious group would be Africans who live and work on the continent. There are Africans who no longer live on the continent, but have a deep insights on the continent. There are, and then there are people who have a deep affinity for Africa, but don't live on the continent. I'm going to mention just three people. There's Professor Naira Hoots, who is the dean of the Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford. She's a Kiwi, has done a lot of work with institutions on the African continent.
Thank you.
And she's got amazing insights, and it's a great, great privilege to have her. Then there's Professor Peter Blair Henry, who was the dean of the Sloan School at NYU. He's a Jamaican, and he feels that he can express an affinity to Africa as a Jamaican. Now he's sitting at Stanford, and he's very, very highly regarded in the U.S. Or you can take Sir Masood Ahmed. Masood is the President Emeritus of the Center for Global Development, long-standing Washington hand, deeply, deeply respected. And so there are people like that. And on the African continent, we've tried to traverse a group so that we have what I call the four foreign language groups represented. So there might be too many Anglophones.
Mm-hmm.
We have a good number of Francophone academics. We have a few Lusophone academics. And then we have a few Arabic speaking. So that when the report needs to be worked through those four big languages on the African continent, we can add Kiswahili and so on in the fullness of time. It's going to be fairly easy because there are panelists who are familiar with the detail, have been part of the organic development of this report. There were also other people who came through other channels. I mean, one of the last people added is the former governor of the Bank of Rwanda, and it was the Minister of Finance, Enoch Godongwana, who said, "She's free now. You really should include her, and she's been a great asset." So it's like that. In fact, there was a time...
You've got Bright Simons on. You're fabulous people.
Yeah.
And then how many times did you all meet?
I think we've had about six meetings, and we've had a number of interactions. I mean, every time there's a revised draft, it goes out, and within 2 days we have comments from virtually everybody. So one of the good things about this group is there's a very strong esprit de corps, deep commitment to being heard. And sometimes people felt very strongly about some of the issues. Now when you try and put together a report like this, it's quite difficult because between one draft and the next, we were trying to get everything in, but also trying to maximize brevity. And the number of comments that we had from people who felt passionately about issues and felt that we'd kind of squeezed those issues out, and we then had to get them reinserted. But it was all done in good spirit.
Because it's what I loved about it is that it's readable. So it's 30 pages, and it's got that feel of the national plan. It's easy to read.
Don't say that because they'll say it's me. It's not me.
No. Okay, cool. So I had to look at the key recommendations. Some are easy, like perhaps a borrower's club. Some more tough, like the review of the IMF. And the engagement with the ratings agencies is one I've been following for a long time because it's something that I think Sim Tshabalala first drew my attention to when he looked so carefully and argued so well that Africa is subject to a different kind of ratings imagination or risk rating. And he showed it in data. Take us through some of the key findings. So maybe we start with an easy one. Or is it the Borrowers Club?
Look, in the world today, the creditors have clubs. The Paris Club is a very important club, as is the Club of London. But the Paris Club is the better known club. And creditors convene and they look at issues and they compare notes. And, the Paris Club has a very good data set. Now, that's all well and good. But the debtors don't have anybody to talk to. And it's the debtors who need to be able to learn from each other. Peer-to-peer learning amongst debtors becomes fundamentally important. And so that will be one of the things that we need to get. So we must get stronger data sets. We must be able to ensure that there's trust and people can talk to each other more freely. Because one of the things that the creditors don't like is full transparency about the terms that apply to various loans. And we're saying, both in this regard and the same would apply in respect of the ratings agencies, drive it into the open. Tell us what data you're using. Let's see what the issues are. And it's a bold move. And the good thing about the idea of a debtors club now is that there have been a number of resounding voices on this. So the... there was a Jubilee Commission report.
Yes, Prof. Stiglitz did that one too.
Did that one too. And that also made a call for a debtors club. I was one of the people who served on the UNSG's expert group on debt. It was a recommendation that we made very strongly as well. And then there was a conference in Seville on financing for development, which was convened in June. Very strong message there as well. There are still issues of detail to be resolved. Some of the northern countries would like to participate. Now, do you have an exclusive club? Or do you allow debtors to get on with the show and later, in the fullness of time, countries can decide who else comes in. But if you have the lenders and the borrowers sitting together, you're never going to get the borrowers having full voice. So this is the issue, and our recommendation is, in fact, that, and we'll ask South African Minister of Finance to start by convening the African finance ministers to talk about the issue, to develop the norms and standards, to look at what it'll entail and to try and take that forward. It's a big, bold move, and we've got to stand by it because there's a lot of goodwill that'll support it.
That, and what did Ms. Hannah Ryder, for example, say? How would such a thing be received in Beijing? Would there be an openness to engage such a club?
Look, and this is not Hannah Ryder. This is Trevor Manuel. My sense is that it's going to be an issue that's somewhat difficult in Beijing. When we did work on the continent in 2020, in the middle of COVID, we were asked by the AU to try and assist countries that were flat on their back. There was a group of us, Donald Kabaruka, Ngozi, Strive Masiwa, Tijan Tiam, and we formed this group and then engaged with a number of lenders. And China was difficult. China would not share the terms and conditions of loans to various countries. And there were some countries on the continent who would say, well, we think that we have debts with certain institutions in that country, but we don't know how much, and the president entered into it, and we don't know what the terms are. Now you've got to outlaw that kind of behavior. The sense is that China's been able to engage countries individually and be opaque about the terms. And so they wouldn't like this. We're trying to have the converse of that. We're trying to have openness about the terms. And with some countries, it's going to be a lot of hard work.
I'm sure. And then, you know, when I worked at Bloomberg for a very short while, Moody's and S&P would release those ratings decisions on a Friday, as they did
always
this week, always on a Friday. And there was never a way to engage their decisions, especially when it was a negative rating. And now you're asking them to open up. How do you make these decisions? Are you fair on the continent?
Well,
that's quite big.
Again, there are interesting bodies of work on this issue. We're able to look at some detail, or in some detail at, for instance, there's an interesting report that was done by the Earth Institute at Columbia University, which is headed by Professor Jeffrey Sachs. And he did an interesting exercise where he looked at the key measures that are used to determine a rating of a country. And would include GDP growth, the debt to GDP ratio, and then you can also use another measure like the spreads on the 10-year bond. And you could cut this thing in any way. But let's just take all of Africa off the table for a moment and look at, and in the fourth column, you could put what the rating is.
Mm.
Look at the U.S. They're down to AA now. They've lost their AAA. Down to AA, debt to GDP is something like 120%. The spreads are like quite narrow, and their growth is like 1 point something. And then you look at India, larger country. Debt to GDP, something like 70-odd%. Growth this year, 8.3%. Spreads in the 10-year bond, 8.5%. And the rating is probably like single B or something like that. So if you just looked at those things, it's clear that the rating agencies aren't using the same lens to arrive at conclusions about countries. And that is the battle that must be waged. And so it's not an exclusively African battle. It's a battle for the developing world, and there's sufficient evidence to be able to demonstrate this. And we're saying to the ratings agencies, we respect your work. And let me just make a point that African heads of state, when they convened in Lomé and Togo earlier this year, argued very strongly and passionately for an African ratings agency.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you next. You can say they must reform or you start your own agency.
I have no mandate to speak on anybody's behalf, but I'm not persuaded that starting your own ratings agency is the way to go. I used to say when my mother was still alive, if I wanted a very good rating, I'd go to my mom. She'd say, my son is the best there is. But would the banker lend to me on the say-so of my mom? I doubt it. So an African ratings agency, would it improve on the rates at which African countries borrow because an African ratings agency? I don't think so. We have to wage a battle with the big three, Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, and try and persuade them, force their issues into the open and get a different set of outcomes on that issue. We need to ensure that countries can borrow at better rates.
They know you know them. Do you think that they are institutions open to such scrutiny? Because what I learned at the Zondo Commission, very different kind of scrutiny there, is that the big management consultancies don't like that.
No, of course they don't like it, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't go for it. I mean, you know, just pause for a moment. I'd spoken about what happened in 2008, especially in the U.S., when you had these collateralized debt obligation CDOs that were actually rated by the same ratings agencies as AAA.
Yeah.
It created the bankrupting of the world. The costs were borne by very poor people. And the ratings agency said, oh, we were sorry. Got a little tap on the hand and they moved on. I think we are saying there is a very definite place for ratings agencies to provide the oversight, the role that they do, to provide the indexation of countries that they do. But we need data transparency to ensure that the system works. And it's a call that we must make and make repeatedly, and we mustn't walk away from it because management consultancies wouldn't like this issue.
You also are seeking such a reset of power with the IMF by calling for a review of how the IMF works. That I found really interesting. Obviously, you hear it in civil society a lot, but this comes from the panel. How would you see that working? And have you floated it with colleagues in the IMF in the meetings this year?
Look, the IMF has been through a rather difficult history. I spoke earlier about the work we're doing in 2020. At that point, the managing director of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, was very forthcoming, very progressive on a range of issues. We were arguing then that these special drawing rights of that sit in the IMF need to be reallocated with a greater allocation to countries in need, because the SDRs are allocated to countries roughly proportionate to shareholding. And the largest shareholders are, of course, the US and European countries. Now, they don't need the SDRs. Countries on the African continent definitely do. So, at that stage, Kristalina was warm to the idea. Warm to the idea of finding a way of supporting also some resource for climate change. This year, a change of government in the US and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, in one of the first statements he made, basically issued an instruction to the IMF to get back into their box. Now, and he spoke of mission creep. It needs to be ordered and it needs to be rules-based. I want to mention, because the IMF doesn't always follow the rules. One of the rules at the IMF is if a country's in arrears, the IMF can't lend into arrears. Now, the country that is actually in arrears is Argentina. Now, President Milei, is a good friend and acolyte of President Trump.
Yes, he pulled out as soon as President Trump pulled out.
But one of the things that the U.S. has done, because it has on its balance sheet in the IMF, it has special drawing rights that have been allocated to it that it won't use. The dollar is the reserve currency. It doesn't need those. Mm. But instead of allocating it to countries of need, it gave $20 billion of that. However they dress it up, there's $20 billion of U.S. SDRs available to Argentina to help tide it over. Now, if it's available to Argentina, there are countries that have actually performed better over a longer period that don't bend the knee to Donald Trump in the same way. The rules-based system must be able to address that. That would be one kind of change that we would motivate for and work for in the IMF. There's another one. At last count, the IMF has 90.3 million ounces of gold. The gold, when it was placed for the IMF, initially $35, but the median price for the gold in the IMF is at $50 an ounce. Now, if you check the gold price now, Ferial, turn on your phone, check the gold price, it's probably like $4,300 an ounce. Now, that gap between the 50 and the 4,300 is unrealized value sitting in the IMF. One of the things that we would motivate for is that be realized, or a chunk of it be realized, because you don't want to flood the world with gold in a way where gold-producing countries that happen to be frequently very poor countries as well are disadvantaged by the measure. But if they revalue, the IMF can have a large pile of cash that they can utilize to help countries that are debt-stressed. What will need to happen is that there needs to be a discussion at the IMF amongst finance ministers, central bank governors, on what the terms and conditions would be for qualification, and then to avail the resource so that the resource doesn't just sit there. It's actually put to good use for the development of the world, put to use so that we don't leave people in poverty when you're sitting with a big pile of value that is underutilized.
That's a really exciting possibility. But do you see it being, okay, so willing ears, maybe not so much. What's the time span wherein this could happen? 10 years, 20 years?
There's actually no impediment to it happening this year, next year. It depends on the voice. And sometimes the voice in the IMF is a very difficult one, because what has happened in the IMF is that by design, the IMF's decision should be taken by the governors, who are the ministers and central bank governors. The truth of the matter is the executive board of the IMF, who are individuals sent by countries who sit in Washington, run the day-to-day operations. And they are exceedingly change-averse in these kinds of issues. I've had major run-ins on a few of those issues. I'm actually young. I'm 23 years old. I look like I do because of the run-ins with those people.
So that's what they've done to you.
That's what they've done to me. But I think it's one of those issues that should be fairly easy to persuade people on and to build a large body of support, not just of the ministers and governors, but also of communities across the world.
Definitely, you can see how. So I want to move to a story about my friend Robert Kabushenga, but first, a story about the inner city where we are now. There's a 10 billion rand economy through this inner city of traders who come from the rest of Africa, come here, they buy, they take their goods out. Tanya Zak has found this in something called the Chaos Precinct. It's really exciting and it's probably not understood well enough. She started that. So I'm a big praise singer for the African Free Continental Free Trade Area. And the report says that we really do need to get this working now. But a friend of mine, Robert Kabushenga in Uganda, he wanted to sell coffee here. And last week he was just in complete despair, telling me at some length about how difficult it is. How do we make this fairly revolutionary piece of a trade accord work better?
Well, what's not in the report are some of my personal views on these matters. As an African, I think that we need to liberate ourselves from the decisions taken at Berlin in 1884, which carved up Africa into 54 separate states. Now, the minute we accord statehood, you need a president, you need a parliament, you need a currency, you need marching bands, you need an anthem, you need all of those things. The truth of the matter is that we need a different engagement with each other as Africans. We need to focus on how we soften the borders between ourselves, because the borders between ourselves tends to be higher than the borders between any of us and the outside world. So we need to soften the borders between ourselves and be rational about it, because we need to focus on the movement of people, of finance, and of goods. And people move. I mean, there's a very strange notion in South Africa that if we make a noise, we'll keep people from neighboring countries out. The truth of the matter is that whilst we were living under apartheid, battling with Bantu education, some of our neighboring states were producing skills. Now, we don't want to denude our neighbors of skill, but we need the freedom of movement of those skills. We don't get the movement of skills, but we do get the movement of very poor, desperate people. And then we say, you see, these people, they come here and they're poor and they kind of mess up our city and so on and so on. We need rationality about it. Poverty doesn't sit in one place ever. I mean, Donald Trump can have ICE now and they can be very abusive towards people. I believe that Zaki Ahmad, coming in from Canada, was detained at Newark Airport. So they can behave like that, but it's not going to keep people out ever. Nobody remains, because you can look at Joburg. Part of what gives it the throb is that people have come in from everywhere to Johannesburg. If that everywhere is somewhere in the Eastern Cape or somewhere in the DRC, doesn't matter. People move like that and have always moved. That's a story of Stimela.
Exactly.
So let's not pretend that you can keep people out. We need a different approach to this matter. It needs a lot of work, a lot of rationality. But we also need to undertake proper research and find what works with what. Now, one of the ideas we have about the report, and I don't want to speak out of turn, but the panelists know that this is where we'd like to take it. So when we hand over the report this week, the heads of state have it. We will put in a plea to take it to the AU heads of state meeting in the middle of February and ask the AU to take this report as its own and to advance it. And the advancing on the African continent is to do what's called an atlas of complexity, region by region. Now, we could be the testing ground for this. South Africa now also has the privilege of chairing SADC because
of Madagascar.
Madagascar can't do it. And if we can do this and apply the norms and standards and SADC, have the academic support and do the research and find out what works with what, stress test all of that work, see how it sits alongside, for instance, the East African community, and the EAC works much better than SADC works now.
Yeah.
Try and revive ECOWAS, and ECOWAS is constrained by the military coups that have taken place in the Sahel and so on. And try and look at Africa for opportunity, not just a continental free trade agreement. An agreement is an agreement is an agreement. We're actually looking for that which flows between countries across borders and will improve on the quality of life of people. The idea is to build economies of scale. 54 countries can't give you scale. I mean, we have these ideas about ourselves, about the number of Africans there are, about the youth bulge and the demographic dividend that we will be able to secure from that. We can talk ourselves into a stupor about those things. The big issue is economics only works if it works for people, if you improve on the quality of life of people. And we can do it. We can do it, but we need to be able to build the license. I mean, in rugby, there's a kind of maxim that says you've got to earn the right to go wide. Mm. We've got to earn the right to become intensive in the way in which the economics finds resonance on the continent.
Very good. And then just finally, how do we ensure, or what does a good outcome look like for you? Because you once said to me that the national plan of the National Development Plan, the NDP of South Africa, it is a beautiful document. And even as I listened to the Madlanga Commission of Inquiry and the Ad Hoc Policing Committee Inquiry, people say, go read what the NDP said on this stuff. It's all in there, the political admin interface, etc. What would a good outcome be like for this report?
It's all about political will. The political will needs to be about how you can push up against the boundaries that present at the moment. And it's about the self-belief of ourselves as Africans. Can we believe that we can implement? If you said, in the context of SADC, these are the parameters that now present. This is how we can reindustrialize. This is how we can benefit from the critical minerals that are beneath the soil in the SADC region. We don't just want people from the north to come in, drill holes, and take everything, leaving us impoverished. We need to change the parameters of all of that. What do we need to support that kind of approach? What legislation? What capital? Who will borrow? How do you deal with what is an impediment at the moment? Because you have 54 countries and you're small countries and your economies are small and the amount that you can borrow is therefore low. You can't borrow in South Africa for a project, say in Zimbabwe. But if you can have a cross-border project that is differently constructed, then you begin to change. You begin to change the economics of the African continent. That's what good would look like and feel like for me. I think that we can work at it. It also means that we need to, as with the NDP, harvest work that has already been done, work with, and we the in the panel at the moment, we have the big Pan-African institutions. We have the AU itself. We have the UN Economic Commission for Africa. We have the African Development Bank. But we're also working with the African Center for Economic Transformation that operates out of Accra. And that those four institutions will be the pillars that'll do a lot of the empirical work with the great African universities and help take this forward. Then we need the ability to ensure that these ideas are socialized into the populace, which is why those language groups become important again, so that we can talk to people not in highfalutin languages, but in a way that all of us as Africans understand and own the content and commit to the outcomes. That's what I hope would be the kind of landing space that'll carry this idea forward.
Thank you very much, Jeff Emmanuel. Best of luck as you present this
report.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you so much for joining our Power Chat with Trevor Emmanuel today. We are because you are insiders. May we encourage those of you who are not to please become insiders. You can join us on the link below.